One thing we do.
I think you can say one thing we do is talk about the author.
I don't know about that one.
That's an unnecessary second do.
Do.
Welcome to Translation. I'm your host, Seth Bannon, a founding partner at 50 Years, a venture capital firm backing founders using technology to solve the world's biggest problems. Translation is the process of turning basic scientific research into therapies that cure disease, new sources of energy that heal the planet, and other things that move the world forward. This podcast takes a deep dive into scientific achievements with huge potential to improve society. We talk directly with the people advancing the science with their own hands and minds, and focus on how we can translate the science from the bench to the benefit of all. Welcome to Translation.
Behind every success, there are people with the courage to try.
To create new sources of energy, to fix the carbon in our atmosphere, to cure disease.
Hey everyone, it's Michael Chavez, co-host of Translation, fellow at 50 Years, and graduate student at Stanford University. Today we are breaking our mold a bit to chat with three people about a true pandemic story. When COVID hit and society decided to deploy mRNA vaccines for the first time, many questions remained about whether RNA itself was ready for the challenge. However, three scientists working at the same university but who had not all worked together yet realized that RNA's limitations were merely a design challenge and not an issue with the substrate itself. Through emails and Zooms, these three built a tool to massively test RNA designs that increase their stability and expression of the protein they encode, ultimately creating a platform to improve these life-saving vaccines. The lead authors you will hear from today, Catherine Lepek, Hannah Waymont-Steele, and Gun Wubion, in collaboration with Anne Cladwang and Craig Kerr, performed this work in the labs of Maria Barna and Ray Judas at Stanford University.
Catherine, Gunn, and Hannah, thanks for joining us on Translation.
Thanks so much for having us.
So every podcast we've done before has been with just a single author. So we're trying something new here. But the story of how you three came together during the pandemic to push forward some truly great science was just too good not to tell with all of you. So to understand where you all were when everything got started, what are all of your areas of expertise and what were you focusing on going into the lockdown? Catherine, why don't you start?
Yeah, so we are kind of a bunch of scientists that have a connection to RNA. In our lab, I'm a postdoc. I'm originally from Germany. I did my PhD in Germany and came to Maria Barna's lab at Stanford to do RNA biochemistry in the context of embryo development. And then my PhD was more on the immunology side.
And Gunn, what about you?
So I was also like a PhD student in Maria Barna's lab, and I was a student in the genetics department, and my background sort of has been with genomics and like high throughput assays. And in terms of biology, I've been kind of studying sequences in our genomes called extremely conserved elements. These are just like basically DNA sequences that, you know, stay the same over hundreds of millions of years across like vertebrate evolution.
Cool. And Hannah, what about you?
So I am a fifth-year PhD student in Riju Das's lab, and so Riju's lab also focuses on RNA. My work has been largely computational, and so, you know, there's a big field in trying to answer the question of, can we predict RNA structures from sequence? I kind of came to RNA late, though, so I joined Riju's group starting with the third year of my PhD. And prior to that, I had more experience in theoretical chemistry and using machine learning, deep learning methods to make sense of other types of large data sets. But the problem of RNA structure and understanding RNA function really interests me because of, like Gunn was saying, there's now all these large scale, high throughput data sets that can be used.
So it's late 2019, early 2020, and you're doing your normal research. And then news breaks that COVID-19 is spreading. It's quickly coming to the US. Lockdowns are starting. Antiviral programs are kicking off. The vaccine race begins. At this point, did you three know each other?
Well, Catherine and I were in the same lab. So, and then we had like worked together, like, you know, quite a lot before, actually. And, you know, we've been a team before, but we, of course, like, didn't know Hannah. Like, I didn't, like, you know, we didn't really meet Hannah at all, actually.
Yeah, so I had worked with Riju Das a little bit before. I was writing a big review with him and done, like, individual experiments, but we've never done a huge project together. But we are in the same building, so we are on two different floors. And so that also, I mean, in the pandemic, that actually didn't matter where we are, but physically, we at least... It didn't really overlap with the DAS lab until the last couple of months where we just ran into each other. But most of our meetings were over Zoom.
The other day I was eating lunch outside and I saw Catherine walking by. I was like, oh my God, it's
Catherine. In the flesh.
So what catalyzed this collaboration? So you're three people with orthogonal and yet because of the pandemic, all of a sudden extremely complementary skill sets. How did you three come together?
So actually, all of this started by Riju Das already being kind of, he has thought about RNA therapeutics since 2018 and kind of making connections to industry. But basically, this project started last year in March, right at the beginning of the pandemic, where he had a lot of ideas how to stabilize and improve RNAs that are potentially useful for therapeutics on a biophysical side, but he needed the biology in a lab that could actually test these sequences. And so he actually contacted then Maria's lab if we want to be part of a collaboration that kind of combines the strength of both of these labs to come up with new approaches to really also make this a very efficient and fast process.
So a computational biologist, a high-throughput experimentalist, and an RNA biochemist walk into a pandemic. Sounds like the beginning of a good joke to me. But seriously, so three near strangers working at the same university decided to come together to help solve an issue that was really only newly relevant in this world. In a few sentences, can you describe the paper that came out of this collaboration to a general audience?
So this paper, we developed experimental methods and also computational methods to design messenger RNAs that are resistant to degradation. And we think this is important because we, you know, the RNA vaccines that have been being rolled out from Pfizer and Moderna, you know, we all have seen the potential for these medicines and they are truly transformative. But also along with their rollout, we've seen that there's been these concerns over their stability. And something that Riju and others in this field have identified early on, you know, RNA itself as a molecule is intrinsically unstable. You know, it's kind of the main chemical difference between it and, say, DNA. But something that we know is that RNAs that fold into structures, so that form base pairs with themselves, are more resistant to hydrolysis. And so one of the questions then was, can we design messenger RNAs that still code for the same protein or antigen, but that we've selected codons that form a sequence that fold into a more stable structure? So that was one aspect of it, but we also wanted to be able to answer this question in the full context of the messenger RNA, which includes untranslated regions. And so for that reason, the collaboration between both the computational side and the experimental side, actually translating these, I think, is the potential of this work that we've done.
Neat. And just to be clear, the stories I'm sure many people heard about of CVS needing to throw out, you know, mRNA vaccines that went unused that day was because of the stability of these vaccines. Is that right?
Yeah. So, I mean, exactly. Like, what went through the news that doses, like certain doses just went bad in a way, that meant that the RNA would degrade or that it's not any more useful on the day if you don't use it. That is the real issue, that RNA as a molecule is just unstable, even if it's complexed into these lipid particles. And there's a lot of room to improve that. And so what we also kind of, part of our motivation was also that we wanted to really look at this in a global way, look at the whole mRNA. How can we optimize every aspect of an mRNA? Because the vaccines that then at that time were not proven to be as efficient or as they are, as they've shown now, how well they work. But it was not clear, because it's such a new technology, what to expect. And so I think what we did is really taking the time to really optimize and look at every component of the mRNA individually and kind of do a global approach, because on the one hand, yes, these mRNA vaccines that are on the market have been designed very fast and have been put into trials very fast just because we needed to have an answer and this product for this pandemic. But we kind of also had the motivation to be fast, but we wanted to be very comprehensive in terms of what are the features that we're optimizing for.
So what were the logistics of working together when everything was in lockdown? I imagine this was predominantly a Zoom collaboration.
Exactly. So I think this was more for the people that actually worked in the lab and did the experiments during lockdown. Was a little bit more challenging than usual. We had the biochemical, biophysical side from Riju's side, but there were also experimental aspects to it. But we had to get approval from Stanford to come back to campus. And I think what was really the big challenge for us as a team was that in usual academic settings, everybody has the one project and you do the whole experiment from design, planning, and executing an experiment on your own. But in this case, we actually had one student who helped us coordinate us when people need to come into lab and do a certain step in experiment. So we basically split one big experiment onto several people, and we were not allowed to overlap physically. So we had to split our time in the lab. And that was a very new challenge because that really needed tight teamwork from everybody involved. And that was actually some learning needed to kind of adapt to that system. But it was very efficient once it was established.
I know a lot of people, because of those necessary rotations, ended up doing a lot of like 3 a.m., 4 a.m. science. Was that the case for you as well?
I mean, you know, not, you know, as extreme, but, you know, I would say, I think like it actually really like made us more efficient because, you know, we might have had like slightly different hours or like slightly different, you know, but because like we had like kind of a big group, like we had, you know, not just us three, but it was kind of like actually lot more people, like with bigger team, like overall, right? And so we were really able to kind of fit everybody's kind of schedule in a nice optimal way so that, you know, all parts of the experiment can kind of really go smoothly and then really efficiently because, you know, we could, if we just kind of like organize it right, we can be at the lab like just very kind of constantly all the time, right? And so, you know, that really worked out very well, I think, for us.
What was most difficult about kicking off a collaboration virtually?
So I think for us, it was actually interesting how coming from the biology and biochemistry side and then talking to the biophysicists and chemists, actually, we also had to adjust kind of our language. Just like we're already at that level speaking a little bit of a different language, so just kind of getting into the same boat and everybody on the same level, and that took a bit. And also just simply everything was transitioning onto Zoom, so just getting into the rhythm of having weekly Zoom meetings with everyone. So it was, again, like, just to emphasize, it's not just us three, but it was from the Barna side, it was 7 people, and from the DAS side, it was 5 or 6. So it's a big team that always met with the PIs and kind of checked in regularly, and then sub teams would check in even more often just because we couldn't talk in lab. So that in itself kind of took a bit to establish. But I think once we had a system, it was actually pretty efficient. And I have to say, in the beginning, there was so much motivation from everyone in the lab to be involved, to help. Like if there's anything we could help, like they were willing to help. But in the end, we figured out a good core team that worked really well together and efficient so that we could move things as fast as we could.
Okay, so within a year, you put together a team, you learned how to work with each other, you completed a project, and you put it all together for publication. This speed is something that we see a lot in the world of startups, but it's pretty rare in academia. You know, and one thing that often brings a startup down, especially when you're moving so fast, is founder dispute and breakup, which I guess in your case would be something like first author dispute and breakup. Did you guys run into any speed bumps while working together in terms of the vision or direction of the project, especially given that you couldn't sort of get in a room and chat things out?
I think that, so the two PIs here, Riju and Maria, I think, you know, since this is kind of their role in managing, and I think that speaking from my perspective, there was a lot that they did that I personally didn't see. But I just want to say for me, I did kind of come from a view of science where, like, you know, I had seen second, like, papers with 2 or 3 joint first authors. But I think just in the line of theoretical chemistry papers I was used to. I was more used to like a single, you know, first author project. And so this experience for me really was eye-opening in realizing that, you know, just a bit of how, I don't know, I personally now view the authorship system to be just sort of outdated, you know, and that seeing if one isn't concerned about being the first author, like how much more one can get done in this team science setting. It's something that I'm hoping that moving forward, expectations or stereotypes can be more accommodating just to like, how do we do the best science with teams of the best people and like not worry about like the author order.
So you hear Moderna announced they're developing mRNA vaccines for the first time at a massive scale. This is quickly followed by announcements from BioNTech and Pfizer about developing their own, you know, COVID-19 mRNA vaccine. What makes these vaccines different from the type that we traditionally employ? And what are some of the benefits of mRNA, say, over, you know, protein or deactivated virus vaccines?
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that goes a little back to what we said in the beginning. RNA is a very modular and programmable molecule. So once you have a good RNA, you can, or an mRNA that performs very well as a vaccine, it's interchangeable in terms of which protein you're encoding. So on the one hand, that is science that is relatively new in the translational side of things, like the therapeutic side of things. But there is more than 20 years of work that got us to this point where mRNA vaccines are working this well, but it just has not been proven for any other. It's not been FDA approved. There is no real good example before this. So what makes RNA so much more, in a way, like as a variant of a vaccine is that it's also mass producible. So protein-based vaccines are traditionally made through very complicated purification setups. So the hope for the RNA vaccine and therapeutic world is really that you can just make a lot in a very short time, which is exactly what we needed for the pandemic. There's also biologically just very elegant aspects to it. So mRNAs are just our natural product that are in any and all cells of your body. And so it has the additional advantage that the vaccine product, the antigen is so efficiently, like the mRNA vaccines works only so efficiently because it is the way that it enters the cell and is presented to the immune system through, in this case, these complexes called MHC class 1 and 2. So that makes it much more visible for the immune system and gives us this 95% of efficacy that we have right now. So there's lots of pluses in terms of speed, reprogram, like modality, flexibility, but also how biologically the mRNA vaccines work so much better.
Cool. So these benefits are huge and, you know, have helped us develop a vaccine to overcome this, I guess we're on the path, a virus. But one of the reasons we haven't seen mRNA vaccines at scale previously was because there were some super large limitations with, you know, RNA itself as a substrate. Can you describe what those limitations are?
One thing that we wanted to optimize and one bottleneck clearly for the RNA therapeutics is the stability in the expression level and the delivery of them into the cell. And mRNA is as intrinsically as a molecule, an unstable molecule that degrades itself, basically. And so to prevent that, It's really important to modify the RNA in terms of its structure and its modification to, on the one hand, make it invisible to the general immune response so that it's not recognized as foreign, but on the other hand, to be able to store it and mass produce it and store it at higher temperatures than when it would need deep freeze, like minus 80 or minus 20. So these are obviously bottlenecks that the whole world is facing, and this was part of our motivation to improve the RNA so that we can store it at higher temperatures, also that we can make it more efficient so we can inject basically less RNA per person so that we don't need to produce as much to cover the whole world.
Awesome. So we need the speed of development, flexibility, and cost effectiveness of RNA, but the lack of stability and poor payload expression has inhibited our ability to do this. But you three didn't see these limitations as something inherent to RNA. You saw it as design flaws that could be overcome with just a little bit of engineering. So what can you do exactly to RNA to make it a better therapeutic?
So I guess I might just rephrase what you just said. I think when we started this, we didn't know if it would be engineerable or not. And so I think that was also just a question that we helped answer. So one aspect that was more my focus from the DOS Lab side was, as I had mentioned before, so you have this messenger RNA sequence that contains these triplets, these codons that code for a specific antigen. And so if you take the number of messenger RNA sequences that all code for, say, the SARS-CoV-2 spike protein, there's actually a huge number of sequences. There's 10 to the 633 different sequences. So one design question that we asked is, can we change the codons in the sequence and find RNA that forms more double-stranded regions, and which the hypothesis was that if it formed more double-stranded regions, it would be more resistant to degradation. So one question was just, you know, if we do that, by how much could we expect to see an improvement in the stability? Another question is, you know, would forming those stable structures, would this make them worse at being translated? So I suppose that's one aspect of how we could design them.
Awesome. So the tool you three developed is called PersistSeq, which stands for Pooled Evaluation of mRNA in Solution Stability and In-Cell Stability and Translation RNA-Seq. This is what we call a massively parallel sequencing assay, which is increasingly becoming the de facto way to do biology. And actually, in our first season of the podcast, we talked with Pierce Ogden, who built this type of assay for AAV. So let's walk through how this works. All of these massively parallel methods start with an input, or as biologists call it, a library. And your library was, of course, a bunch of different mRNA designs whose sequence to structure to outcome relationship you were looking to understand. For each RNA in this library, you varied both the coding sequences, so this is what would be akin to the spike protein, and the non-coding sequences, as you called it, the UTRs, to find some design principles for each. So let's start with this non-coding part. Where on these RNA vaccines do these non-coding elements occur, and where did these elements come from? Where did you draw these UTRs from?
So what we had really wanted to get it is, and that has not been done before, is really on the several layers of input sequences. So the Barna Lab was more looking at, okay, what has evolution already invented? So we looked at we just went into the literature and looked at the viral sequences of UTRs and structures that need exactly to do what we want a vaccine to do. So we want high stability and high expression after a virus hijacks a cell, a host cell. But then we also looked for mammalian and eukaryotic and plant sequences that have been shown to enhance translation or enhance stability, and really combine everything in our library. But then for the UTR sequences, to have a readout, we used a nanoluciferase reporter gene as our coding region instead of the spike protein.
This coding region, this nanoluciferase, which of course gives off a luminescent signal if it's active in the cell or expressed in the cell in this case. So you were interested in understanding how the structure of that region can change this outcome, right? And to do this, you guys took a look at a citizen science approach, correct? What did you do here, and why did you leverage this citizen science resource?
So the Eterna game was developed by Riju Das in 2011, I believe. The original premise of the game is the game gives you a particular target structure. So it might be a cloverleaf shape that a tRNA might take on, or it might be a totally synthetic shape like a smiley face that some other player has made a pattern for. And the goal is to try to design a sequence that folds to that particular cloverleaf or smiley face shape. And it turns out that that's not an easy computational problem to solve. It's something like NP-complete for people who have looked at it. And so when Riju and a co-founder at Carnegie Mellon first made this game, they were really just trying to see what could we make a platform to, you know, see what folding principles of RNA that humans could devise. And so an important point about this too is that players would design solutions that would then be submitted. And then a staff scientist who works with Riju, her name is Anne Cladwang, she would then synthesize these molecules and perform structure mapping experiments on them to see just how well did the molecules actually fold to the structures that they were predicted to fold to. And so then there would be this cycle of hypothesis and results and feedback that was all happening on this community science platform. And so there's been a number of other papers from the DOS lab. Some have been written entirely by citizen scientists that have developed new principles for RNA design. And we've also been able to improve the algorithms that we use to do those structure predictions. And that's been the topic of my PhD work in particular. So we had this platform of these aficionados for RNA folding who already knew all sorts of, you know, so in RNA secondary structure, there's a whole zoo of different little structure motifs. There's kink turns and there's multi-loops and there's bulges and there's tri-loops and there's this whole nomenclature that we have this whole base of players who are familiar with. And so it was pretty straightforward pivot then to say to participants, okay, instead of designing, you know, RNA that folds very stably into a smiley face, we want you to design this new RNA. It codes for a nanoluciferase protein. And it doesn't matter what particular structure it folds into, but we just want to see how compact can you make it. And so part of my work on the computational side was also just developing a metric that biophysically represents how we would model degradation. So basically, what is the probability that each backbone linkage is unpaired and more flexible? And so we turned that metric into a score on the game that we then asked players to try to minimize this score. And so we would launch cycles of, we call them rounds, on the website and collect solutions from those. And those solutions that we collected would then form part of the library that then went into the PersistSeq experiments.
Love that. So you essentially leveraged humanity in a way that, like, the brain power, I guess, of a computer is just not set up to look at.
It's really remarkable to me also, because we found that players, you know, could design highly stable structures, say for nanoluciferase, but also the different structures that they were able to create are ones that would just take an algorithm a very long time. So some, you know, one aspect of RNA structure that we and players were also very interested in, just how branchy could they make molecules. So you could imagine, you know, a very branchy RNA that looks like a spider or something like that. Or you could imagine just one single long double-stranded RNA that looks like a worm or something. So I love that in one of our figures, there's an RNA that's called something like Bugak Man's Worm Refined Kaggle Style, which is predicted to just form one single long double-stranded RNA. And so, you know, whether that is translated efficiently or not is a different story. But it was to be able to test those aspects, it was important to first design molecules to have all these crazy structures. And so that was a part that human creativity, I think, really lent itself.
I mean, also just to add to that real quick is that everybody can participate. So you don't need a science background. But I just also tried. I joined and I tried and went through the tutorials, but it actually doesn't help you much if you have an RNA background like I have. Like, it is really the playing aspect to it, and really being good at video games that helps you there. So I was not very good at the game.
Great. So you have a tube full of RNA and you needed to see how stable it was both inside and outside the cell and how good it was at making protein. And then, of course, whether it stays in solution. Traditionally, you have to do this one at a time, right? You would take a petri dish full of cells, force a single one of these RNA designs into them and measure what happens. Then you would take a different design and you would wash, rinse, and repeat. But obviously, this is way too slow to do more than a few times, which has traditionally limited the number of designs you can check. Instead, you go the massively parallel route, which means you check all the designs all at once in one petri dish, and your job is to come up with a clever way to untangle the data that has now been pooled into one sequencing run. So let's start with just translation efficiency. How are you able to take this complex mix of cells expressing various mRNA designs and assign a value for how well a specific mRNA design in that library is translated into protein?
So we lyse or break open the cells and spin this fluid on a centrifuge using an old-school technique in biochemistry called sucrose gradient centrifugation. And this separates the different particles in the cell based on their density,
So at the end of the spin, mRNAs loaded with lots of ribosomes come out on the bottom part of the tube because they're heavier, while mRNAs with fewer ribosomes come out on the top because they're lighter. More ribosomes mean you're translating better. So this means that when you now split up the tube from top to bottom, you effectively separated the mRNAs by how well they're being translated. You can now sequence the barcodes on the mRNAs from each of the split up fractions. And since you know which barcode corresponds to which mRNA design was, we can now identify which was which in the pool and assign each of those an average number of ribosomes they had, so how well they're translated.
Right. Yeah, that, I think that's brilliant. And so going back to that translation piece, though, right, you slap all of your library into cells, you run this kind of fractionation method, and what you can do is say like something like non-coding sequence X was better than non-coding sequence Y at initiating translation, right? And when you looked at the data, you noticed that one region had the biggest effect on this. What was it, and why do you think this region is so important?
Yeah, so we saw the biggest variability in terms of varying translation rates in the 5' UTR, and that is the region that determines how well an mRNA gets loaded with ribosome and initiates translation. But it is important to distinguish between what we then call ribosome load, so how heavily is an mRNA loaded with ribosome, so in the process of translation, versus the actual protein output. So this is still something that is different that we had to confirm later on, that what we find in terms of variability of how well mRNAs get loaded with ribosomes, how well does that then correlate with the protein output? Because in the end, we want the mRNA vaccine to be most efficient at making protein. So this, our initial experiment was focusing on ribosome load, because that is what our sequencing experiment can read out.
Right. Cool. So knowing this, were you able to create some kind of design rule of the 5' UTR that would, you know, quote unquote, maximize translation?
Yeah. So in the end, there were two aspects. On the one aspect that was clearly room for improvement was the 5' UTR, where we saw the biggest variability. But we also saw that the coding region actually is also pretty variable in how well an mRNA can get loaded with ribosomes. And that was actually also surprising to us, because we thought it was not known that when we make these very highly structured coding regions, that the ribosome could still translate efficiently these coding regions, because it still needs to go through these strong structures. So that was surprising to us. But yeah, so we, as an example, we worked on the SARS-CoV-2 5' UTR, which is in itself highly structured. And so there we ask, as like one example of a structured 5' UTR that itself would be beneficial for in vitro stability in the solution, can we make that even better? And so we mutated the 5' UTR, and we also could improve the ribosome load of these constructs. So there's still some more synthetic biology that we can add on top of what we already have in our library. But yeah, so the 5' UTR was definitely the region that was most variable.
Awesome. So the next piece you looked at is stability of mRNA in the cell, right? It doesn't matter if the cell is great at translating the mRNA, if it just degrades really quickly once it gets in there. So how are you able to measure this in a pooled format?
For the RNA stability, we collect samples from multiple time points and measure how much mRNA remains at the different time point, again, by sequencing the barcodes that identifies each mRNA design. Now, we don't specifically try to start with the same amount of mRNAs in the pool that we transfect into the cells. They're starting at different amounts at time point zero, but we can look at the rate at which they're decreasing over time, and this tells us how stable RNAs are.
Cool. And again, you were able to ask which region had the biggest effect on stability, which you actually in the paper wrote that you guessed something beforehand. Was this hypothesis correct? And if it wasn't, what did it end up being?
An expected outcome would have been that the 3' UTR, 3' UTR sequences would lead to the biggest effects on stability. But actually, we observed that the variations in coding region sequences, at least among the designs that we've tried, led to even greater differences in RNA stability inside cells. I mean, interestingly, this was not really correlated at all to the degradation patterns you see in solution/syringe before they enter the cells. So it seems that there is kind of an active cellular mechanism that's causing the coding sequences to significantly influence the stability of mRNAs inside the cells.
So now you have in hand both data for stability and translation efficiency, but you notice something troubling when you correlate the two, right? If you improve the translation efficiency, it seems you're also in some ways reducing the stability in cell, a trade-off that makes designing a vaccine far less clear, right? But undeterred, you gathered some data and performed some modeling to create a design rule that balances these two things. And so how did you do this and what did the rule end up being?
So we used a very simple kinetic model where an mRNA is translated at a constant rate by the ribosomes to produce the proteins, but at the same time also is being degraded in an exponential decay inside the cells. Since we're measuring the translation rate and the decay constant from our pooled assays, the PERSIST-seq, we can write an equation for this relationship to predict how protein production rate changes across the lifetime of mRNAs after they get inside the cells. And that allows us to find sort of a sweet spot where we can try to hit the maximum in the total amount of proteins that are produced. One important thing to note is that, as we mentioned before, increasing translation does actually synergize with stability until we reach a sort of a tipping point where it now reduces it. And so our experiments are based on one main reporter gene, the nanoluciferase, but we would actually guess that depending on what gene it is, this tipping point may be pretty different, maybe due to the difference in their length or translation elongation rate. So it will be important to determine what such a sweet spot may be for a particular vaccine protein coding sequence that you're trying to design.
So one of the worst features of RNA is how easy it is to degrade in solution, right? And so even someone like me, who's not a specialist in the RNA field, has definitely accidentally ruined a tube of RNA by just blinking at it incorrectly, right? And so how did you measure in solution stability for your mRNA designs? And what are the biggest drivers of RNA degradation here?
Gun, Catherine, correct me if I'm missing parts, but so the way that the in-solution degradation experiments went, so the same pool was subjected to accelerated degradation conditions, so we didn't want to have to wait around for a month collecting time points. So they were degraded at pH 10, spacicity is something that increases degradation. The pool was then just sequenced, and there were primers designed so that at each time point that RNAs were collected, the full length remaining construct, the amount remaining could just be measured out through sequencing. And so there were a couple different predictors that we wanted to develop in order to be able to predict how much does an RNA degrade. There had not really been a huge amount of data collected on just the degradation rates of different small RNA structure motifs. So to try to make a better model just for simple in vitro RNA degradation, we again went back to Eterna and asked participants to design short RNA fragments. So they're only 68 nucleotides long, and the only directive we gave was just to maximize the structure and sequence diversity, put in as many different types of structures as players wanted to. For those libraries, then those were also subjected to accelerated degradation. These were experiments performed by Anne Cladwang, who's another author on the paper. These were useful to us because we developed a method called inline-seq. So we kind of repurposed other structure mapping high throughput experiments to get a per nucleotide readout of degradation. So instead of just one number per RNA degradation, this meant at every different linkage, we could get a readout of that degradation rate. And I then developed a model that used that data to create one particular metric that we called the DEG score. And that it was a very simple machine learning model, but it told us new things about just what RNA motifs degrade more or less. So like kind of a surprise was that if you have a loop of unpaired nucleotides in an RNA, we thought that, you know, we expected there to be some variation just in how does the surrounding structure affect an unpaired nucleotide degradation. But we found that actually, like if you just have a single loop inside between two stems, if it was asymmetric, it had a higher degradation rate than if it was a symmetric loop. And so that, you know, there might be a number of reasons for that. But so these sequence and structure effects on degradation kind of got baked into this deg score metric. We found that then the predictions from that metric correlated better than other models that we had developed kind of along the way based on simpler biophysical principles when we compared their predictions to the measured in vitro half-lives from the PERSIST-seq experiment.
Love it. So again, using the collective brain power of humanity, you were able to create a new predictor. Right? Essentially, you added machine learning on top of how humans think, which I think is a super, super interesting way to go about that. So just to recap all of this, you know, it seems like highly structured UTRs improve protein synthesis, whether it be through improving stealth stability or translation potential. And through citizen science, you found that in-solution stability is better if the coding sequence is highly structured and had this lower DEG score. And then finally, in the context of vaccines, where a single dose is given, it might be better to optimize for in-cell stability than translation efficiency, which is something you kind of touched on briefly in the paper. When you put this all together, how much better was your optimizations than the run-of-the-mill designs?
So if we're looking just like at one of those multipliers, so like the CDS design, we found that there was roughly a threefold increase in the in vitro stability. For me personally, this is very satisfying because that's also what our models predicted. So that was cool. But then also, yeah, if you take into account the pseudouridine substitution, that I believe also was maybe like a twofold increase.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's around 2.5-fold. What we can get, and the combination as one of the last experiments that we've done is really putting everything together and looking at what happens when we degrade the RNA with and without the pseudouridine over time in solution, and then transfect that RNA and see if that also correlates with the expression. And so the answer is yes. So we can improve the protein output and follow that over time, and our improvements in terms of CDS structure plus the pseudo-U give us this 2.5-fold increase overall. And it's persistent over time.
So, you know, you obviously built a powerful tool for the new age of therapeutics that we're in, right? Was PERSIST-seq deployed for COVID-19? Or is it being used for any of the boosters to make better vaccines?
So the companies that make the vaccines right now, they have their own in-house kind of algorithms how to optimize their sequences. But of course, they were also putting out the sequences that are out there now were from the first, they only took like 2 weeks to design their RNAs. Like we took a year to look at every aspect of RNA. So, I mean, there is a lot of room for improvement, but they are also doing similar things than what we do. And I mean, we have patented all our methods and designs. So if any of these companies want to use these approaches, they can ask for licensing. So this is possible, but we don't really exactly know what companies are using, but I'm sure they're also very internally also working on similar approaches.
So what else do you see PERSIST-seq being applied to, right? There's, of course, cancer vaccines, and there's the viral vaccines that we're looking at. But, you know, what else is out there that might benefit from RNA? And how do the design rules that you developed change under these different conditions?
So I think we're just at the beginning of RNA therapeutics, so we don't really know what else other kind of approaches could potentially be adapted to RNA. I think this is exactly what happens right now. That because of its like flexibility that you can change out the coding regions and suddenly you have a vaccine for cancer or for heart disease or for malaria. So there's so many potential applications to this that we didn't kind of design it with a certain, I mean, of course, we wanted this to be useful for this pandemic, but we didn't really think about let's make this as modular as possible for any other application. I think it is, but it's intrinsic to the RNA. So it's like if design rules persist, then this is applicable to any other molecule that you want to design a vaccine for or an RNA therapeutic for.
I think beyond therapeutics as well, even just for, you know, high throughput transcription reactions in some initial work that in our lab has happened. You know, transcription reactions take place at 37 Celsius or higher. Even just making RNA molecules that are able to hang around longer to have more of your full length product is a good thing. And so it's my hope that these sort of, you know, the algorithms that we developed can just be broadly applicable to making RNA.
Awesome. And what other output measurements do you think need to be added to PersistSeq so that you can create these better designs?
Yeah, I think what we always wanted to do and didn't get to in the end is really to move this into immune cells and really see if the output in terms of if we optimize protein production, does that actually correlate also with a better immune response? Because in the end, you want to see, yeah, if you're making the right amount of protein that the immune system sees the peptides.
So you've mentioned quite a few exciting directions for this technology that could have both real-world impact, and you could imagine also creating large commercial value. But that won't happen, you know, without great effort. Do you three plan to help take this method out of academia into industry? And if so, how might that look? Do you start a company around this, which I think could be very exciting? Or do you simply, you know, license these methodologies to a Moderna-like company?
Everything that we've done, every aspect of the method and the design of the RNA and the algorithms are all patented and has actually been fast-tracked through this pandemic. It was very impressive to see this. But and yeah, so if companies want to use these methods, they can license individual parts of it.
And, you know, along those lines, if there is some potential future explorations of a startup, is that something that, you know, you three might actually be excited to help push forward?
So I think what I hope comes through with this, having this done as a group and having five first authors on this paper, is really that this is a massive team effort. And the idea of team science, even in academia, makes so much sense. And also just seeing that this paper came together in a year or 1.5 years now, that from start to finish in a pandemic with kind of Google Sheets and everything online, everything movable, and everybody has access to everything all the time, is something that was new to all of us, but it worked out really well. So I think if this can be transferred to any other academic project or in the setting of a startup, this is the way to go. Like this approach to science is really, really powerful overall. And I think we're all kind of still on the academic track, all three of us. We're really excited of what could potentially come out of this and be involved and helpful there.
So I want you to put on your most, you know, optimistic hats when answering this question. You know, imagine it's 10 years from now and everything has just gone swimmingly well with development of this technology. What could this tech enable? How might the world be better?
So I think we're just seeing the beginning of RNA therapeutics being like the RNA vaccines for COVID-19 were kind of the proof of principle that RNA biology in a setting of medicines work. So I think there is probably a lot of shift happening in the big pharma departments of really thinking about RNA again as like not the complicated, unstable molecule that it is, but really the potential of how flexible and how elegant the method is and how efficient and how well it works for in this setting. I mean, there might still be settings where it just doesn't work and we don't know that. Maybe this is also just particularly primed for fighting a virus like this and in the vaccine setting, and for other applications it might not work as well. But I think the next 5 to 10 years are going to be very exciting and for any RNA biologist or biochemist.
As a concrete image of something I would love to see, and I don't know what if this is 10 years or more, but you know, it's that there's a novel virus that crops up in sub-Saharan Africa. And because it's just a matter of recoding a messenger RNA, as soon as the relevant spike protein is sequenced, we're able to make a design. And then because we've figured out how to make these sufficiently shelf-stable, that they're then able to be rapidly delivered and that sub-Saharan Africa cold chain is not an issue to actually get them to populations where they would be most needed, to be able to quench pandemics, you know, to get before they spread globally.
Hannah, Catherine, Gunn, this is very impressive science, and the future translation potential is incredibly exciting. So looking forward to seeing what you three do there. Thanks for joining us on Translation.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having us.
I hope you enjoyed that episode of Translation. If you're an author of an upcoming paper in bio or know of any interesting papers dropping soon and want to hear from the authors, send us an email to translation@50.vc. We'd love to hear from you. Until next time, good bio.